Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Drinking water contamination has been an unsettling concern for some New Hampshire communities, especially regarding two chemicals known by their acronyms, PFOA and PFOS. These are used in manufacturing items that have a non-stick coating, stain-resistant carpet, for example, or firefighter clothing. But both these chemicals are linked to illnesses, ranging from cancer to thyroid disease. And both are what the EPA calls persistent, meaning they hang around instead of breaking down when exposed to air, light, or water. That also means they stay in drinking water and in human blood long after first exposure. Since cases of contamination came to light in the Seacoast and in the Merrimack area, huge efforts have been underway to test and improve water supplies. And today in The Exchange, we check in on this story, what we've learned, and what might happen next. Let's get your questions in. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have four guests for the hour. Clark Frisey is here, Assistant Commissioner at the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. Mindy Mesmer, a Democratic State Representative from Rye and Newcastle, who sits on the Health and Human Services Committee. Dr. Ben Chan, the State Epidemiologist at the Department of Health and Human Services, also a physician. And Emily Corwin, reporter for us here at NHPR, who's been covering this water contamination issue. Welcome, all of you. And Emily, I want to start with you. We're going to be talking about two main areas where these chemicals have been a concern that you've been covering for a long time. Just put us in those places, please, Emily. First, on the Seacoast, what happened?
So on the Seacoast, at the former Pease Air Force Base, as has been discovered at military bases across the country, what has been used since the 1970s in firefighting foam, a very effective way to fight fires, are these chemicals that have been discovered to be linked to a number of human health problems. And so these have leached into the ground and into the ground water and into the water systems. You know, first we discovered a number of years ago in at the former Pease Air Force Base. And then later, coincidentally, just as I was moving from covering the Seacoast to covering southern New Hampshire, I hope it's not doesn't have anything to do with me, the company Saint-Gobain, which manufactures sort of non-stick materials, so hazmat suits and airport seal, you know, roofs and stuff like this, right? Very non-stick, slippery materials. They've been in southern New Hampshire and Merrimack for decades and have been manufacturing those things with the same materials, the same sort of chemicals as is in that firefighting foam. In their air emissions, that's leached down into the ground, into the water, and affected drinking water in southern New Hampshire as well.
Wow. So two areas of the state that have been of concern, both happening completely around the same time, or Pease was discovered first, Emily?
The contamination happened in you know, different sort of timelines. Saint-Gobain showed up in Merrimack a few decades after the firefighting foam began being used on Pease. As far as the discovery of the contaminants and the investigations, those, I think, sort of, Clark, actually, you should speak to this.
Yeah, go ahead, Clark. Give us a little bit of a timeline there. Just remind us, because this is big news for several years now.
Yeah, Pease actually was discovered, if you can say it, before the contamination by Saint-Gobain and also by TCI. They actually were occurring probably about the same time period, in the 80s. These chemicals were very heavily used. Class B aqueous film forming foam, AFFF, Definitely was used very heavily by the military, both in training and in actual aircraft accidents. As Emily said, it's an amazing capability. What it basically does is forms a foam that separates the fuel from the air. And so you can have an aircraft come in with no wheels, spill all of the fuel in the tanks, and not have an explosion.
Wow.
And it's very, very effective, and it's been used for a very long time. The military's been trying to replace the PFOS, the sulfonate, in that to come up with a chemical that works as well but does not have these health concerns. And that's just starting to get used now. A number of fire stations in the area have used these foams in the past. Primarily, they use what we call Class A AFFF, which is same sort of foam, but it's for ash bearing, so paper, wood, things that would create an ash. And so that's a lot different, and that does not have PFOS in it. So if you see a firefighter using foam, you don't necessarily have to be worried. Generally, it's Class A foam, and that does not have PFOS in it.
Well, and Dr. Chan, how dangerous are these chemicals, PFOA, PFOS, and the whole related class of chemicals? What do we know about their impact on human health?
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually, if I can take a quick step back for a minute and just mention that these chemicals go by various different names. We've been calling them perfluorochemicals or perfluorinated chemicals or PFCs. This is a large group of chemicals that have been used very widely in industry. And so you get down to very specific names like perfluorooctanoic acid or PFOA or perfluorooctane sulfonic acid or PFOS. These are just a couple of the different types of PFCs that have been found to be used in various products, including in firefighting foam, as has been mentioned. You know, there has been study of these chemicals for decades. Most of the studies that were out there up until, you know, 5 or so, 10 years ago were animal studies and studies of occupational workers, people, workers in chemical factoring, manufacturing plants that have been exposed to very high levels. And over the last 5 or so years, there's been more of an explosion of evidence coming out about these chemicals. But you know, there have been health effects shown that these chemicals cause in animals, but the evidence for humans is conflicting. So there have been different associations in the health literature between PFC exposure and various health outcomes. But there's still further study that needs to be done on these because association does not necessarily mean that these chemicals have caused these health outcomes that have been studied in humans.
Now, that's an important point. So association doesn't mean causation. So just for the layperson, explain what that means, Dr. Chan.
Yeah. So when these scientific studies are done, you know, the scientists look at the level of exposure to these chemicals and they can look at a variety of different health outcomes. And sometimes they find a statistical connection between, you know, people that are exposed to higher levels being more likely to have a certain health outcome that are studied. So an example of this may be thyroid disease or elevated cholesterol. But these studies are usually population-based studies, and so they're limited in their ability to tease out sort of this cause and effect relationship that's being studied. And so oftentimes what we find is that there may be other factors, what we call confounding factors, that aren't necessarily being studied or addressed that may have contributed to the findings in the study. Or the findings may be due to just statistical chance. You know, anytime you do a statistical analysis, there's a likelihood you're going to find something significant. It doesn't necessarily mean that the finding is true or that there's that cause and effect relationship.
So, Representative Messmer, I understand you got involved in politics because of these issues, concerns about the health effects of these chemicals. What were you hearing from people in your area that inspired you to run for office?
Yes, thanks for asking. So I was elected, I think, basically because of my identification of a cancer cluster in children in my district in the Rye, Newcastle area, Portsmouth area. In 2014, I reported to the Cancer Registry. And in 2016, the Department of Health and Human Services said that the CDC did, yes, define, it's a CDC-defined pediatric cancer cluster, actually two different types of pediatric cancers. And now we also see some elevated rates of brain cancers in children in our area.
Wow.
So I think that, you know, as part of my experience as an environmental scientist, people looked to me and I started to was asked to serve on the governor's task force. And, you know, that kind of got me elected, I think,
so
to focus on that issue.
Go ahead. Yeah.
And so I just wanted to head back a little bit on something that Dr. Chan had brought up. He did talk about some human health studies that were done. And one of the biggest studies that's been done is actually in connection with DuPont in Parkersburg, West Virginia, where DuPont did a big study as part of a lawsuit on 69,000 people that were exposed to PFOA in adjacent to their plant there. And that C8 Science Panel study, it's called, actually identified some probable links between exposures to PFOA in groundwater as drinking water and also some of the plant workers there that included various cancers and high cholesterol, like Dr. Chan mentioned. So I just wanted to talk about the fact that those studies were done. But most of the studies have been done in connection with, you know, the chemical manufacturers themselves so far.
So this has been going on for a couple years, as you all have said, and, you know, concerns have been rising, and there have been some scary connections that people are making. I want to ask all of you, and maybe you first, Clark, so where are we at now in terms of a response, either from the state government, the federal government, the private sector, meaning the companies themselves? Just where are we at now, Clark?
Well, as a state, we've been very aggressively trying to go out and find out where there is a potential health vector, a threat to public health. And we have over 30 active investigation sites around the state right now.
30?
Yes. A lot of them are landfills, former industrial sites, places where people have just gone off and done their own testing and discovered elevated levels. And as we search around, we find there are more elevated levels. The two biggest sites by far are at Pease and in the Merrimack, Litchfield, Manchester, Bedford area. The next sites down would be the Amherst site, where we've got about 100 homes are being put on public water by the company that was responsible. That's moving forward now. In the Merrimack, Bedford, Litchfield, Manchester area, we are going to have about 500 homes put on public water, hopefully by the end of the summer. We've already had over 250 homes put on in that area. At Pease, they put treatment on two of the wells. They're working on treatment on the third well. That obviously will be good to get that back online. A lot of the smaller sites, we're not finding as much. There's a lot of concern with landfills in particular because people took these materials, which were used in a ton of products, and then they threw them in the landfill. And obviously those landfills do have contamination. And what we're generally finding is the monitoring wells at any of these landfills, we find very elevated levels, very, very high numbers. And then as we go to the homes that are outside, we're not finding significant elevation in their water. So far, we've had one home around all the landfills in the state that has gone above the state standard of 70 parts per trillion. Other than that, everybody else has been down at lower levels.
And you're talking about measuring water, not people's blood levels in these
Correct.
Areas.
Yeah. Yeah. Dr. Chan is in charge of blood. I'm in charge of water.
Yeah. Well, and just to clarify, you know, roughly 60-65% of New Hampshire is on public water supplies, Clark, right? So it's mostly people who got their water from wells that have this concern?
It's closer to 50-50.
I see.
As far as wells versus public water. We do have one public water system that is impacted. The Merrimack Village District has two wells known as MVD 4 and 5 that did have elevated levels. Those have been red tagged, and they are designing treatment to go on those two wells so that they can come back online.
Okay, so the people who were on these wells, some of them are now getting hooked up to public water supplies. Can we assume public water supplies are not, you know, also infected with these chemicals?
Yeah, we do test, obviously. All the public water systems are tested very regularly. With this emerging contaminant, we've been asking the public water systems to go out and test. So far, other than wells 4 and 5, no public water system has come in above the state standard of 70 parts per trillion.
Okay, lots to talk about. And Dr. Chan, I can see you want to jump in. And Representative Mesmer, go ahead.
I was just going to add that, you know, these are chemicals that have been used very widely, not only in industry, but also in our everyday home products. And so when Clark talks about where we're finding these chemicals, they're going to be essentially found everywhere. I mean, they've been found as far away as the Arctic or the Antarctic and in animals. These chemicals don't break down in the environment. They persist and they bioaccumulate. They're used in our everyday home environments, anywhere from manufacturing stain-resistant carpets to stain-resistant furniture. They're used in the manufacture of water-resistant clothing and stain-resistant sprays. And so when Clark is talking about investigating landfills, you know, all of these chemicals that are used in our everyday environments have the potential to leach down into the water, contaminate the water. And so this is going to be a big emerging sort of national problem.
Bioaccumulate sounds a little creepy. What does that mean?
Yeah, so that just means that, again, the main way that people are going to be exposed to these chemicals is by consuming them orally, either through contaminated food, contaminated water. And so bioaccumulation just means that these chemicals have the tendency to build up in somebody's body because they can last for a long time. So the half-life on some of these chemicals, that's the time it takes for a body's level to go down by half, is on the order of, you know, 4 to 5 years for these two PFCs, PFOA and PFOS. And so if people are consuming these chemicals in drinking water, for example, and then not removing them, you know, quickly, then they tend to build up. That's called bioaccumulation.
Go ahead, Representative Mesmer.
Yeah, so I just wanted to circle back a little bit on so another site where we've been looking at this PFC issue, which sits geographically right centered in the pediatric cancer cluster, is the Coakley landfill, where very elevated concentrations of PFCs have been detected in the surface water that flow off into Rye, Greenland, and Portsmouth, and as well at Pease, in surface water bodies around Pease that flow into Great Bay and various other places. So there is a significant issue with regard to surface water that we haven't really talked. And a lot of the private wells, in our area are somewhat connected to surface water for supplying, recharging the bedrock wells that people drink from. So that's a concern of mine. And also, so the Portsmouth water supply at Pease was the first that Clark mentioned, was the first identified impacted with very high levels, and that caused the elevated blood levels of a bunch of people in the Pease area that drank the water. So that was the first human impact that we see in the New Hampshire area. And then I also wanted to talk about the fact that, you know, the state has done a really good job at looking at a lot of different areas, and I'm really happy that they have. There's a school that's on drinking water, a bottled water supply. They have around 20 parts per trillion, so that's a really positive step, I think, in the right direction, that we're not going to expose those children to more than 20 parts per trillion by providing them with bottled water. And there have been a lot of areas where these compounds have not been detected at all. So it's not everywhere, but it is significant. There is where you see landfills, there are, probably products that were discarded in those landfills that contain PFCs, but it isn't really everywhere. And there are places where it is really elevated, and we can usually probably point to specific sources of those compounds in the water.
Yeah, and you mentioned 20 parts per trillion, and in a little bit we will get more to that's the measurement level and what's safe and what isn't, and some discussion around that. But Emily, to you too, you know, we've been looking at, okay, what's been the response? Everybody's talked about greater awareness. Clark talked about hooking people up to public water supplies. What other responses have happened since this first started breaking a couple years ago, from the federal government, from the state government, from the company?
So, at the state level, it's been a lot of focus on remedying the current water supply. So taking, in cases where it's necessary, taking some wells offline, in other cases, hooking people with private wells that are affected up to public water supplies. And I think that is, something that's really effective at just helping, make sure that people who are over the state's threshold get access to remedies. Something that obviously can't address is all of the water that people have drunk in the past. And so if, today your water has been remedied, you still have maybe spent 10 or 20 years drinking water that may have had very high levels. And so then the state has been providing blood tests to analyze, for people who are over the state's threshold, how contaminated their blood may be. One answer that's not one question that's not answered by that process is, what effect does that contaminated blood have on your health? And I happen to know we'll be talking about health studies a little bit later.
Yeah, absolutely. And for the people involved in that aspect of it, it's one thing to get your water improved. It's another thing to find out that you have elevated blood levels. That's pretty concerning. So we will definitely pick up on that in a moment. We'll also hear about how Vermont approaches this issue differently than its neighboring states. All that's coming up, plus your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477.
This week on the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop, author Michael Cunningham has advice we can all take to heart no matter what you do.
You have to figure out when it's time to just let it go, when this is all you can do. Over the years, I have developed a slightly better sense of when I've reached that point, when in rewriting, I'm not making it better, but I'm just making it different.
Subscribe to the podcast for sage advice or find some at nhpr.org/10mww.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, it's an update on drinking water contamination, a story that's especially concerned several regions of the state, including the Seacoast and the Merrimack-Litchfield area. We're finding out what these contaminants are, what their health effects might be, what actions have been taken, and what questions remain. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, we started talking about what levels of these chemicals are considered safe by the EPA, how a few states have different levels that they consider safe for humans. For a little bit more on that, we're joined now by Sarah Vos. She's the state toxicologist at the Vermont Department of Health. And Sarah, good to have you. Thank you for being with us.
Yeah, good morning.
So, Sarah, what is the level that Vermont sets for these chemicals, these PFOAs and PFOSs that we're talking about?
In Vermont, we established a health advisory level for PFOA and PFOS so that the sum of those two chemicals should not exceed 20 parts per trillion.
20 parts per trillion in water or in the human body?
In drinking water.
In drinking water. And how did you determine that level, Sarah? That's well below the level that EPA has set.
Well, EPA has a guidance level, but there's no federal regulatory level. So EPA does have the responsibility for setting regulatory levels for contaminants in drinking water. And when there's no federally enforceable level, states are on their own to come up with what's appropriate for their state. And, you know, every state has a different process. We in Vermont have a process to establish these levels in drinking water for chemicals that don't have federal regulatory levels.
So federal regulatory level means the federal government says you must not allow these chemicals, you know, above and beyond this certain level. A guidance level is we suggest that you don't do this. Is that the difference, Sarah?
Yeah, that's right. The federal level has legal enforcement capability with it. It's the MCL.
So the federal government's guidance level is 70 parts per trillion, right, Sarah? Am I correct on that?
That's true. And when we looked at all the information that EPA had presented, we did use most of their information in our calculations. So we used the same toxicity endpoint. We used several of the other same pieces of information in our equations. The only difference in what we did in Vermont versus EPA is that we looked at how much water an infant drinks. So instead of looking at how much water a lactating woman drinks, which is what EPA did, we looked to the 0 to 1 year old as being the most sensitive population, and we based our calculations on that.
So that's how Vermont came up with a different standard than most other states.
Yeah, and again, when there's no federal MCL, you will see different states taking different approaches. And, you know, there are several states that have come up with other numbers, and some of them are closer to 20, some of them are higher. But if you look at the process, each state has a very different process, and some states have a process based on different toxicity endpoints as well.
Okay, and Sarah, just stay on the line with us for a little bit. I want to bring our New Hampshire guests in, and Representative Mesmer, go ahead.
Sarah, you mentioned other states, and I just wanted to sort of mention the Minnesota, the recent decisions by Minnesota to come to much lower levels as well for PFOA, 35, I think, and 27 for PFOS. And those were based on similar endpoints that were used by Vermont. Is that correct?
Yes, I believe that's correct.
Okay. And Dr. Chan, how come New Hampshire so far has decided to stick with this higher EPA standard? I should probably call it a guideline rather than a standard.
Well, I will just start by mentioning that actually New Hampshire Department of Health works very closely with the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. And so we had some colleagues in the Department of Environmental Services that looked at and assessed these EPA health advisory levels. But I will say that the EPA health advisory levels for drinking water are meant to be lifetime health advisory levels. So a level that's a guidance for what's considered safe over the lifetime of an individual, including in infants all the way up through adulthood. And so Sarah Vose is correct. You know, the EPA based their guidance on the water consumption of a pregnant woman, with the rationale being that a pregnant woman is going to be consuming more water. And so if you look at this for a normal, 75, 80 kilogram person, based on the water consumption levels that they used, you're talking, 4 or more liters of water consumption a day that the EPA is basing their health advisory off of. I will also make note that this level of 70 parts per trillion that the EPA came out with is not a cutoff of between, something bad is going to happen above it and something and people are safe below it. These are levels that are based off of animal studies, and then extrapolations are made to try and apply them to humans. And through that process, through the calculations, there's intended to be a margin of error built into it to be protective.
So given what we know, Dr. Chan, about the young human body, especially, a baby when things are really happening, given what we know about chemical exposure, is there a case to be made for going lower, for not infecting, if I could put it that way, our youngest residents so that they grow up healthy?
Yeah, well, I would
maybe we know a lot now about early childhood and impacts.
Yeah. Yes. And I believe the EPA levels are meant to be protective of infants and, breastfeeding, nursing infants even. And I guess I'd look to Clark for a little more input here. Some of these levels were reviewed through the Department of Environmental Services.
Go ahead, Clark, and then Emily. Go ahead, Clark.
Yeah, and the EPA did actually in their drinking water health advisory put out that this was based on prenatal all the way through life. So it is a fully protective standard for any age. The goal with that is to make sure that there's no impact. And most of these studies are actually done where there's no indication that the body even notices the chemical is there. They set it so low. And then they put a safety factor on there because of the uncertainty. These are emerging chemicals. These are new. But this was set up looking specifically at a youth endpoint. Because it's protective of youth, it's protective through life also.
Go ahead, Emily. Question on that, but go ahead first. Yeah.
Okay. So I just want to, we're talking about a lot of really technical things. We're talking about technical things with water contamination, technical things with health. And I want to step back a lot and try to explain to people who are listening right now who may be confused what is sort of really happening. And what's happening is we're dealing with potentially toxic chemicals. And to do a real health study, there's really only two ways to get good science about what the effects of these are. One is unethical, and that would be to feed a sample of people these possibly toxic chemicals and see what happens. And we can't do that with a good conscience. So we don't have the good science from that. The other way to find out what the real consequences of consuming these are is to study a huge number of people who have already consumed them. And that is extremely expensive. And it's something that right now the federal government is trying to decide whether they want to do. And so we can talk about that later.
No, I'd like to hear about that actually, Amy, because you and I talked about this before
we
went on the air, that because of this peas contamination, obviously it's terrible.
No. But I really want to finish my point, though.
Okay.
I promise to talk about that.
Because that's another, that could be a case study for this.
Go ahead. But what I want to say is that what we've been left with in the absence of either of those two kinds of studies is this uncertainty. So we know that these are likely dangerous, right? But we don't know exactly how. We don't know exactly what is going to be caused by consuming them. And so what we're left with is a decision from the policy standpoint of can we and how protective should we be given that we don't have certainty? The costs are often costs that business take, right, or that the state has to take in providing remedies. So taxpayer money, business profits are sort of at stake. And so the question at hand is, in the absence of good science showing exactly what the consequences are, do we lay down very protective rules, right, to protect human health because we don't want to risk anything? Or do we lay down rules that are reflective more of the science that we do know, which is a sort of lesser standard?
So most states, Emily, have taken the latter path, but Vermont and Minnesota and maybe New Jersey are taking that
more protective standard. In the face of uncertainty.
Yeah, I can see one jump in, Representative Messmer.
Right,
ahead.
Yeah, so I just wanted to follow on that a little bit. As Emily said, that most states are really looking lower, and one of the bigger databases that have been used, New Jersey's developed a really good database of information behind why they've decided to go down to 14 parts per trillion for PFOA. And that's based on looking at the levels in serum that would result from drinking 70 parts per trillion, various levels. And what they found was that drinking 70 parts per trillion would actually result in 5 to 8 times higher than the national average of PFOA in someone's blood. So that's and these are chemicals that, you know, there's 40, like Dr. Chan mentioned, there's 40 classes of these. We don't even know how to analyze for some of these. So we feel like if, you know, we're looking at only two of these in terms of regulating them. And so in order to be more protective, we don't know what the future health impacts may be on children who are developing, you know, their immune systems prenatally. They're developing their brain. Lots of development happens in those early years. And so when you're exposing children to all various, and not just PFCs, there's lots of other things. Arsenic, lead, all the other things that we know, you know, have heard about are there in water. Do we want to err on the side of being more protective of these children when we don't really know the full science is out there yet? Or do we want to, so I would say we want to err on the side of being more protective.
Well, and I want to go to our listeners and get their questions and comments in. But Sarah Vose, again, state toxicologist for the Vermont Department of Health. Any last thoughts from you on this issue?
No, I mean, I think it's a good conversation, and I think every state is going to be left in a sometimes awkward situation when there's no federal guidance, and we all have to use our own policies and procedures to come up with something that works for us.
Okay. Sarah, thank you very much for taking time out. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Again, that's Sarah Vose, state toxicologist for the state of Vermont. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at nhprexchange. Here's an email that came in from Tom that gets to what we were starting to get to, Emily. He says, would your panel comment on the recent funding secured by Senator Shaheen's office for a longitudinal study of those impacted by the Pease water contamination? Is the funding secure, and can anyone comment on the nature of the study and how long it might run? Emily, I want to ask you about this, but anybody else, please jump in. This is the idea that, okay, we don't have a lot of studies on this, but here this happened at Pease. It's terrible, but it's an isolated place. It's something that you can measure at Pease and at Air Force bases around the country. So go ahead,
Emily. So let me just sort of set up the sort of dramatic moment that happened in May at the ATSDR meeting. That is
ATSDR
a jumble
is what?
Of words. It stands for the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry. But what really people can really think of that as just an arm of the CDC.
Okay, it's a federal agency.
A federal agency, and so basically. Pease had been identified, the former Pease Air Force Base, as an excellent starting place for the feds to start to study the impacts of these chemicals. And for over a year, there have been regular meetings with all of these federal representatives, particularly from the CDC, to discuss the feasibility of studying the health effects. And there was a lot of optimism. And in fact, in May, this past May, after a year of going back and forth, the agency came back to these community representatives at Pease and said, yeah, there are things we could study here.
We could learn something from this.
And in the same meeting, well into the meeting, the Air Force representative is asked, so, like, you know, how's the funding going? And this Air Force colonel stands up and says, and I'm going to read from the minutes here, our legal team looked at it and said, we don't have authority to enter into this type of funding arrangement because we don't have authority in this area, so we can't fund the study that's being discussed here. This is after a year of sort of assuming that the Air Force was going to be able to cough up some money. So this has left the state in a sort of frenzy. What? You know, we have the feasibility study. It comes in like looking good. Go ahead. And no funding. So why doesn't Mindy take it from there?
Well, and I want to let listeners know that Senator Shaheen's going to be on our program next week. So we'll have an opportunity to ask her about that. Tom, thank you for the email. Real quick comments from other people and to Dr. Chan, too. Like, what would you learn from this study if it were going to be done?
Yeah, I just want to echo partly what Emily said is that, you know, we are in an area of uncertainty here, and that's very difficult for people that have been exposed to this. It's difficult for the health department knowing what to tell people when the questions come up. What does this mean for my health? That's something I think that we've all struggled with. And so I think we recognize that more needs to be done to learn about these chemicals. But as Emily mentioned, you know, there needs to be, in order to best assess health effects from these chemicals, there needs to be a very, very large study that has more participants than I think what can just be included here in New Hampshire. And so for that reason, you know, we've been dealing with these contamination issues for, you know, more than 3 years, going back to 2014 now here in New Hampshire. And so we have been working and engaging our federal partners like ATSDR, that's the agency from the CDC, around trying to address this on a national level. So address this by coming up with, you know, consistent national health guidelines to consider doing a national health study that's more likely to provide actionable information and answers around health effects from PFCs. And so ATSDR engaged the community at the Pease Tradeport, and they did this feasibility assessment to try and determine, was it feasible to do a health study and look at various health endpoints. And I think this document is public, but you know, you can go and you can look at the various health endpoints that ATSDR has proposed studying. A lot of the health outcomes that I think people are most interested in were health outcomes that, like cancer outcomes, for example, were things that ATSDR felt they would need a national study to do. Now, they put a price – now, just to give people an idea about how much this might cost, the ATSDR put a price tag on just studying the Pease population at about $10 to $15 million. So
as part of the Department of Defense budget,
which is
ginormous. I'm not really sure how big it is.
Correct. And then the Air Force came back with a statement that they didn't have regulatory authority to fund such a study. And so there have been efforts nationally looking at trying to fund not just a study at Pease, but a study nationally that's more likely to provide science and actionable information to learn more about these chemicals.
Because you have a bigger pool, so you can look at Air Force bases around the country. So it would be useful information. I can see you want to jump in, Representative
Sure.
Mesmer. Go ahead.
We are so fortunate here in the state of New Hampshire that we have our federal delegation pushing for this for us. Senator Shaheen, who's going to be on here, as you mentioned, has been a very big force in getting money appropriated for this in the budget, and as well, Carol Shea Porter, our congresswoman. And they've got actually successful gotten $7 million appropriated in for the budget for 1 year to start these studies. So that's
the money
really,
has been appropriated.
Yeah.
To
well,
Tom's
I mean, it's
question.
Not final yet as much as, but it is in. It still has to go to Committee of Conference, I believe, in between the House and the Senate. But it's in there, and I think, you know, it's going to be a difficult thing not to approve it at this point, in my opinion. But
Clark's shaking his head.
Yeah, actually, neither the authorization bill or the appropriation bill for defense has passed yet. It is in there right now, and obviously there's a lot of push to keep it in there. Mm-hmm. But as of right now, neither budget has passed and certainly has not gone to conference.
And the House report actually has a good long section of information on why it's important to study this.
So it's true that this could happen, and our national representatives. I wanted to mention very briefly, when we talk about uncertainty, there was a huge study that gives us a lot of certainty about what a lot of these chemicals do to human health, and that's negative. It's bad. You don't want to. We know that. What all this uncertainty and these studies would show is what drinking smaller amounts of these chemicals may or may not do to human health. So just to clarify that.
Okay, and we will talk a lot more after a short break and start taking your calls. So join us at 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, an update on drinking water contamination, especially by two chemicals known by their initials, PFOA and PFOS. We're finding out where these have been problematic in the state, what actions have been taken so far, and what questions remain. The Exchange number for you to join us with your own questions, comments, concerns, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, let's go right back to our listeners. Jim's in Keene. Hi, Jim. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Okay, well, I'm very happy to be here. A couple of things. First of all, 3M invented this stuff in the late 40s. And when they sold it to DuPont in the early 50s, DuPont was anxious to buy quite a bit of it. They made it clear that the stuff was lethal, and it had to be disposed of either through incineration or in a chemical waste facility. So the fact that this has been a problem for quite some time, I shouldn't say a problem, but has been a lethal product for quite some time, has been well recognized. I should also point out that DuPont and their spinoff Chemours, which is something they set up to take the liability for a lot of this stuff, recently concluded a $1 billion settlement in the Mid-Ohio Valley. Now, that's just the first of quite a number of these. By the way, that billion dollars may grow. But part of that, the initial part of it, was $350 million, which paid for a six-year health study called the C8 Science Panel.
So there is some studies out there that give us good information.
The fact is, you have to be willing to look at it. And part of my problem with DES is we always seem to be behind the curve. I represent an area out here in Swansea which has 25 straight houses, at least, number continues to grow, that have multiple cases of cancer. Now, that's a result of MTBE. But in fact, when I look at the state's guidance on MTBE, part of it is that they've accepted the secondary standard that the EPA has, and in part that's designed, as their own literature indicates, to help ensure consumer acceptance of the taste and odor of MTBE in drinking water.
Well, Jim, let's talk about that. And Clark, since you're here, you know, the idea that DES doesn't come down as tough as it could be on these chemicals. What do you think?
I disagree with Representative McConnell. I think we follow the science. And when we know that a chemical is a problem, we go out and we sample for it. We sample very aggressively so that we can find out what the extent of the contamination is. When we know that there is a health risk, we attempt to address that health risk by taking it away. In the case of PFOA, it's a very good example. We've taken almost 3,000 well samples to make sure we know where this chemical is. We immediately, if anybody is at 70 or anybody in their neighborhood is at 70, we put them on bottled water and we test the bottled water to make sure it's clean. We get asked that occasionally. And then we try and get a permanent solution into that neighborhood as quickly as possible. All of that takes time, all of that takes effort, but we definitely are focused on public health.
What do you do when the EPA has a guideline, as Sarah Vose from Vermont told us, but there isn't a hard and fast standard that's been, you know, probably studied extensively and so forth?
Yeah, and this is a good case with PFOA, just sticking with the same chemical. They had what they call a provisional health advisory, which is a short-term exposure. So you're going to be exposed for only 20, 21 days. And that's obviously a higher level because you're only going to be exposed for a short time period. We were very fortunate. Our elected representatives, senators, and representatives really pressed on EPA that we needed a long-term, lifetime health advisory, at least to give us the science that they had at their hands put out in a peer-reviewed manner so we could really use that. From there, once they put that out in May of last year, we then have to come up with an enforceable standard.
Wow, just in May of last year, because we've known about these chemicals, as our caller says, for some time. So I'm kind of surprised the EPA like just came out with this.
It takes a long time to go through their process, a frustratingly long time. But they had it out for public comment and peer review for years. And they got that completed. They did push to get it done. We got that in May of last year. The nice part here in our state is we do have the ability to put enforceable standards in place. Right now, for these chemicals, there's only three states that have enforceable standards.
Not just guidelines or suggestions, but
right.
Enforceable standards.
Vermont, Minnesota, and ourselves are the only ones who have enforceable standards at this point. We got that done very quickly. We do have that ability, and the legislature was very helpful in letting us go ahead and do that first through emergency rulemaking and then permanent rulemaking.
Jim, thank you for the call. Representative Messman, go ahead.
Yeah, so I just want to circle back on what Representative McConnell was saying. There was a, I think it's totaling now $1.5 billion actually in settlements and related to the C8 Science Panel study. And in that study, 69,000 people were studied and a minimum of 50 parts per trillion was used as a baseline cutoff for drinking water for a year. So in that study, we know that some health effects were seen at below 70 parts per trillion.
This is the Ohio study.
This is the DuPont study in Parkersburg. And so, you know, I'm really glad the state has gone out and sampled a bunch of areas. But my issue with stuff that I've been directly connected to with, like, say, Coakley, is there are people that live around Coakley landfill that are now drinking water that has PFOA and PFOS below 70. But they also have these other PFC components in them, other chemicals that are not regulated that total up to sometimes 70 or greater. So just because we don't know what the exact health effects are of these other PFCs, that doesn't mean that they're okay for people to drink necessarily. And I would contend that our whole process of how we approve for use in our state for these chemicals should be revised. So we look at structural similarities and maybe that we can assume that the health effects for various PFCs will be the same as the other ones if they have the same structural similarity. And we should err on the side of being more protective. So those people that are living around Coakley landfill right now that are drinking like 35 parts per trillion, if their house was in Vermont, they would be provided bottled water. So that so that difference is difficult for people to understand. You know, why is it that, you know, if I lived in Vermont with the same well, I would be provided bottled water? Does that mean it really is safe for me to drink? So I think these are the things that we're talking about. And a lot of my legislation last year was targeting, you know, have another look at these health studies. A lot quickly happens in these emerging contaminants. There are other states that have gone lower. There are other states that are proposing to go lower. Delaware Riverkeeper has just done a petition of rulemaking to the state of Pennsylvania saying, let's look below. Let's say maximum 6 parts per trillion. And lots of scientists say 1 is really where we should be looking.
Wow, so that's even way below
way
Vermont's
below. And, you
very
know,
tough standard.
Actually, scientists at our Northeastern Conference said, you know, we don't see a point at which we don't see health effects. So, you know, this is important to look at. And so my legislation was that I had in last year was to have another look at these studies that have recently been done and, you know, come to maybe a lower standard.
Well, Jim and Kane, good to hear from you. And let's go to Paul in Peterborough. Hi, Paul, you're on the exchange. Welcome.
Yes, thank you. I've been sort of forced into the position of drinking bottled water for 6 years. And the thought occurs to me, or question is the bottled water itself tested, whether it came from in-state or out-of-state? And you're saying that not all states have the same testing. And I'm also curious about a danger that might exist just in the container itself. So I'll leave you with that question.
Well, Paul, I'm sure it's a question that a lot of listeners have. And Clark, maybe to you first. So you mentioned bottled water testing. You get lots of questions from people about that.
Yeah. So in the case of the state, we have a contract for emergency water, for bottled water delivery. It's with Monadnock, and we do test that. We've done 3 rounds of blind testing. We don't tell them we're doing it. We pull a bottle out that's being delivered to a house, send it out for testing. And so far, it's been non-detect for all PFCs and VOCs, each of the 3 times we've tested. Just did the last one about a month ago. As far as other bottled water, this is not a chemical that is standard is tested for in a standard screening. These are emerging contaminants. There is no regulation on a federal level. And so right now, most bottled water is probably not tested for these chemicals. In our state, we have asked all of the public water systems, some of which are used for bottling, to go out and do testing. And so far, we, other than the 2 wells in Merrimack that I mentioned before, we have not had any above the state standard.
Go ahead, Emily.
So this just brings up this issue of, you know, we know to be concerned only about the chemicals which we test for. And the caller's question about, like, are the bottles themselves safe? I think it is a completely legitimate question. I think we know that plastics generally are likely causing all kinds of health effects in all of us that we that are, you know, only barely being studied.
And there's been a trend more towards people using glass bottles and metal
right,
bottles and so forth.
But I it just made me want to mention that as we've phased out these long chain perfluorochemicals, we know that Saint-Gobain and Merrimack is using shorter chain chemicals that are, you know, virtually the same. And they're called sort of Generation X chemicals. They're sort of like the new Teflon. And so I think it's worth asking our policymakers and, you know, what do we want policymakers to do in the face of uncertainty? Because these shorter chain chemicals, scientists say, are likely very similar to the ones, to the longer ones, but simply understudied. So...
Well, so what do we know? Maybe Dr. Chan or Clark, what do we know about this newer Generation X chemicals that Emily mentions?
The chemicals, as was mentioned before, usually are an 8-chain carbon. C8 is the older generation. They have gone to new ones. One model is called Gen X. That's actually the name of a chemical, not a generation. And another one's called Adana. And we have been working with labs to come up with testing methodologies to test for this out in the environment. We are trying to work right now with EPA's Office of Research and Development. They have very, very advanced capabilities to go out and find what's in the environment, even if they don't know in advance what chemicals to look for. And we're hoping to get them out in the next couple of weeks and do some testing.
Okay, Dr. Chan, and, Representative Mesmer, and then back to our listeners.
And I will just say very quickly that many or most of these alternative PFC-type chemicals have not been studied in humans, so we don't really know what the health effects of these are. The reason why they're moving from some of these longer-chain PFCs like PFOA and PFOS to the shorter chain is because theoretically there may be less toxicity because of the shorter chain. They don't have as long of half-lives. They're excreted much quicker from the body.
That persistence we talked about earlier.
That persistence is less, but we ultimately really don't know what the health effects of these are because they haven't been studied.
Go ahead.
Yeah, like Dr. Chan said, there's only been one one study on the short chains that I'm aware of conducted by DuPont-Camores that looked at the short chains and in rats. And what they found is, yes, it's not coming out in their blood, but the scientists think that possibly that's actually being absorbed into the organs more readily than the C8s were. So it actually may not, it may appear to be at first glance that these may be safer, but they may actually not
be. I see. So they may bioaccumulate in the organs instead of in the blood.
Exactly.
Yikes.
The same target organs are starting to look like they're being targeted. And I just want to go back to the caller's question for 1 minute. So the BPA was a big issue with bottled water, you know, the plasticizer that was used in bottled water. They replaced it with another a similar thing as we're talking about with the foams and the Gen X. And I think I just saw a study by a high school girl who did looked at the bottled water and what was actually in the water. And she saw really high levels of these replacement BPA chemicals in the water. So this is it's all the same type of issue that we're, you know, are the replacements really safer replacements?
Well, now, because you see, now you get plastic water bottles and it says BPA free.
Yeah,
and you think, okay,
yeah.
I just bought some yesterday
cans,
myself. So.
Exactly. But are they really safer? And if they're leaching out at these high levels into the water, do we really know that they haven't studied enough to know if they're safe, in my opinion?
Paul, thank you so much for the question. And to Laureen in Merrimack. Hi, Laureen, go ahead. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
I've lived in Merrimack since 1985, and last year when I heard all this news, my reaction was very similar to most people in town. Lots of people came forward with health issues that are very much known to be associated with the chemicals. Saint-Gobain has been here a long time. They were ChemFab before them. The state is probably well aware that there's a documentation for many years of complaints from residents in a certain area of town about air emissions and various things that I've heard from people. So we have concerns about, first of all, corporate responsibility. Second, we know, as you said in the show, we've had long-term exposure here, estimating 10 to 20 years. What we're testing now in our water is not capturing what we have in our blood and what health concerns are of people. So I hit the ground a couple months ago and tried to get out in the community to gather some health concerns with an online survey and a little bit of door-to-door work. We were able to get responses from 207 households. People are having much of the same thing to stay. And the overwhelming question that people have is if they have concerns with their health that they feel may be associated, they don't feel validated. They want to know what's in their blood. We had some residents petition and go to the town last fall and advocate for blood testing. The answer was that they were going to do a 200 random sample of public water customers. My understanding is those results will be out in September. In the meantime, We have seen a little bit of blood results. I've seen some from some Amherst folks, and I've seen one from Merrimack. And I can tell you that I believe the national average is between 2 and 5 in blood for these chemicals. The Merrimack resident who had lived here for 2 years had 63 parts in her
blood.
Oh,
my goodness. That's a big difference, isn't it, Maureen?
Yes, it is. And the Amherst residents who have lived there long term, one of which is an office manager and one of which a teacher I know in Amherst, their serum levels were thankfully a lot lower. Their well testing, you know, was pretty much in line with that. And the X factor here in Merrimack seems to be, we know we've had exposure. We know this corporation is still probably practicing in the same way. We know that they haven't been real responsible in the past by many, many complaints that people have made. And
so what's being done?
Did get into our groundwater.
Yeah. So, Laureen, I'm
unable to access our blood tests.
I'm so sorry to jump in on you, but we're running out of time on this program, and I know people want to jump in. So thank you for calling, Laureen. Dr. Chan, you first, and Emily?
Yeah, so there's a lot there to respond to, and I can appreciate the concerns that have been expressed not only from the Merrimack community but from others as well. And, you know, and this is something we've heard from many residents over the last few years. You know, what does this exposure mean for our health effects? And so I think I can say that the Department of Health has been trying to address community concerns and meet community requests in a number of ways. The first of which is to try and learn more about these chemicals and synthesize the information. And so you've heard about the C8 study and the C8 science panel. That's one study amidst many. And so we've been working with regional and federal partners to review the science, to put out evidence-based information and guidelines, not only to the community but also to the healthcare providers that are going to be faced with questions around what does this exposure mean. We've been conducting biomonitoring or blood testing to provide individuals and communities with more evidence and information about levels of exposure. And then we've been working with our federal partners to try and move this agenda to address these health concerns more into the national arena, where larger national studies are more likely to provide answers for people about what health effects these chemicals may have on people.
Well, maybe getting that Air Force study up that we talked about, because that would be a national look. I'm sorry I can't get everybody else in on this. And Laureen, I really appreciate you calling in. And I think we need to revisit this issue. So thanks, everyone, for coming in. Representative Mesmer, it was good to have you.
Thank you so much.
That's Mindy Mesmer, a Democratic state rep from Rye and Newcastle. Clark, good to see you. Thank you.
Good to see you.
Clark Frisey, Assistant Commissioner at New Hampshire DES. Dr. Chan, thank you also.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Dr. Ben Chan, the state epidemiologist. And Emily Corwin, a special thank you for you today. This is our last program with you. You're moving on to Vermont Public Radio. They are really lucky to have you. We're going to miss you. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Laura.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.